This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, 6 years after 9/11, where do we go from here? 6 years after 9/11, we look back at some of our programming since 9/11, and particularly at our program September 10th, 2002, 9/11 False Flag Operation. I'd like to read to you from the beginning of that program. In the immediate aftermath of the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, authorities already were sounding the alarm that a terrorist network was involved, and they specified Osama bin Laden and Islamic fundamentalists in the Al-Qaeda network. The authorities did not disclose, however, that this very network has been established by the Central Intelligence Agency, and that Osama bin Laden and his associate, Gulbuddin Hekmet Yar, had received $6 billion from U.S. intelligence agencies, specifically to create a terrorist network, not merely in Afghanistan, but in Pakistan and beyond. In Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and the surrounding area. The authorities, we noted, were quick to point the finger at a demonic figure. But if we look carefully at the press at that time and in the years since, we find that, in fact, the U.S. government, its intelligence agencies, and its spokespersons were not telling the truth. 9/11, we said at the time, is a false flag operation, an intelligence term signifying that the blame has been placed elsewhere to conceal the U.S. government authorship. Where have we been since 9/11/2001? And what does it mean for each and every one of us involved in social and political change? Where do we go from here, particularly as the United States heads towards another presidential election in 2008? Ralph?
Well, Maya, I think it's important to understand that the events of September 11th, 2001, although they have served to provide a kind of defining element of the criminality of the American ruling class, of what we here at Taking Aim have called treason at the top, that this phenomenon of 9/11, namely a staged event by the United States authorities themselves, an attack within the United States designed to create a climate of fear and hysteria, and indeed an opportunity for numbed acquiescence on the part of our public, presumptively, to permit permanent war, and an agenda that American capitalism has long had as its target of strategy and of future politics. Really, Maya, what we've attempted to do in the years that we've been documenting not merely the false flag character, and when I say not merely the false flag character, let me emphasize this point. Anybody who's been involved in anti-war work, in anti-imperial struggle, in mobilization on behalf of the oppressed has had to take note of the fact that power is enormously concentrated in our society. As we've often cited, 1% of the population owns more than 95% of the wealth of the rest of us combined. And as the figure who we like to quote, Robert Townsend, who was the former president of Avis and American Express, articulated it, 5,000 people control what he called the commanding heights of the United States economy. They command the means of production, corporate and banking capital, and they average 14 corporate directorships per person. We cannot separate the analysis of 9/11 from understanding the structure of power in American society. And let me just make a brief point about that. At the time that we in Great Britain with Bertrand Russell and internationally as well were organizing a struggle against the war in Vietnam, and we provided a tribunal, an international tribunal on U.S. war crimes in Indochina, one that has bearing on the question of a tribunal or a commission about the nature of U.S. crimes with respect to 9/11, we provided a documentation through Jean-Paul Sartre, Bertrand Russell, Lelio Basso, myself, and many others, of the history of what we now call false flag operations. namely every imperial adventure proceeding on the basis of such false operations, pretexts, the seizure of Mexico proceeding from a false flag operation, attributing to Mexican soldiers the operations of U.S. soldiers themselves, sinking the battleship Maine in Havana Harbor, and then on the basis of that operation of the United States government proceeding to seize Cuba and the Philippines. 9/11 is the little continuation of that. It is not a matter of a conspiracy on the part of a cabal or a clique or an elite or a secret team. It is the normal workings, the systemic operations of capitalism itself in an imperial age. That's the defining character of the events of September 11th. Whether we document the uses of funds, puts and calls on options, we follow the money with respect to the flooding of the stock market at, 2 days before the bombings in London. We follow Zakheim's, the rabbi dubbed Zakheim in the Pentagon, $7.2 trillion without a paper trail, all of this while he operates a particular company called Triadata that manufactures a mobile unit for controlling airplanes from the ground, for overriding pilot control, all of the elements of what define what happened on September 11th in the context of how capitalism works today. We have proceeded to document over a period of 6 years. This movement now has to ask the question, which way forward? And that's what we're concerned to address here.
And Ralph, specifically, I'd like to take note of one particular aspect of the imperial reach, and that is control of the resources of the world, just as with the colonial enterprise and the accumulation of countries and the seizure of particular resources, so we have with the imperial reach. In 1997, the price of crude oil was $20 a barrel. In 2001, it had already, after the events of 9/11, increased 35% to $27 a barrel. Would it be there today? Today, in 2007, the price of oil is $75 a barrel and moving, as Hugo Chavez said, towards $100 a barrel, 400% increase. Today's price is a 275% increase since 1997. And we should look back at the attempts to control oil throughout history, because this is not, as you always say, a matter of one political party in the United States or another. They may have differences about their means, and usually they come together on the means. After all, look at the escalation of forces, and it was Harry Truman who, after all, we had with the launching of the atomic weapons. So we have here in specific documentations in the 1970s, the focus on Arab oil, Robert Tucker in 1975, writing, seizing Arab oil fields by direct military intervention, a blow-by-blow description of what we've seen with Desert Storm 1991, and again the second launching with the attacks on Iraq with after 9/11. In 1975, again, Miles Ignotis, who we've discovered is the CIA asset, Edward Luckbuck, writing in Harper Magazines, one of the seminal documentation of the plans of the administrations to seize Arab oil, and the title of the article itself, Seizing Arab Oil. And this article is a blueprint for the 1991 Desert Shield, 16 years later, which became the military operation of Desert Storm. Ralph?
Well, Maya, if you actually look at the First World War, if we understand that the San Remo agreements and the plans of the dominant capitalist powers at the time, having mobilized the Arab populations to resist the Ottoman Empire and to overturn it, British and French capitalism, German as well, proceeded to carve up the Arab East between them, with the United States in that moment as a relatively junior partner in the enterprise. And what we are witnessing here, because on the eve of the Second World War, Franklin Roosevelt made it clear to Winston Churchill that he was taking over from the British in Saudi Arabia. Let's look at this very concretely. We are now on the cusp of a huge economic crisis in American capitalism. The subprime crisis, subprime mortgage lending crisis, and the derivatives and the fictive capital and the paper shuffling that arises from a profoundly indebted and deficit-ridden economy flow from the Great Depression, which has never been exited by U.S. capitalism. One of the myths that many of us in our movement subscribe to is that somehow Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal extricated American capitalism from the Great Depression of 1929. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, at the height of the New Deal, in the second term of Franklin Roosevelt, there was a depression that dwarfed that of 1929, with 17.8% of the workforce unemployed and no answer whatsoever on the part of capitalism. None of the makeshift corporatist measures that go by the way of New Deal reform, which were designed to buy time for corporate capitalism to reestablish itself and to abort revolutionary response for American workers, was able to resolve the crisis. What did they do? From 38 to 39, they indebted the United States to the merchants of death, and employment was associated with military production, and indeed the United States capitalist economy has been addicted to arms production ever since and in ever-increasing doses. Imperialism cannot maintain itself without essentially a Bonapartist and military state. And the realities are that since the addiction of capitalism to arms production, the enforcement apparatus, the Pentagon and the intelligence agencies that service it to enforce the imperium abroad, have come to dominate the face of capital and the political process in the United States itself. Over four decades, Maya, $10 trillion were allocated to the Pentagon alone, and that's official money. But $10 trillion is more than the combined value of everything produced in the United States. So we are cannibalizing the infrastructure of the society to sustain a rapine capitalist dominance of all productive forces and working people in the United States itself.
And, Ralph, aside from the militarization, the giant military-industrial complex that supports the imperial reach abroad, we have to point to the police state America. The incredible militarization of the security apparatus in the United States, and particularly the escalation since 2001 of what the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, calls the surveillance state. The deepening through the use of computer technology, through the intertwining of the communications network and the incredible reliance upon the American populace in terms of both the commercial and also the consumer parts of the American economy, the reliance upon computer technology, this affords very much easy and reliable surveillance state, be it business records, health records, education records, and where we who we talk to on the phone, the communications records, whether this is through regular technology, the landline technology or cell phone technology, the use of the internet, who you what sites you access. It goes on and on. Again, Ralph, I want to go back now to the imperial reach. And we discussed in tiny bit, we've discussed over the years in great extent the imperial reach throughout the Middle East and also Central Asia. Because just like in the 1970s, they were discussing seizing Arab oil. Throughout the 1990s, the discussion was about control over Central Asia. And the prime aspect, the first thing they had to do was to break up the Soviet Union and so that you had the Central Asian states, the republics that had been part of the Soviet Union, and these became the so-called independent states. And also seminal to this is control over Afghanistan and a reliable client regime in Pakistan.
Well, what you're describing in this process, which is the grand chessboard articulation of Zbigniew Brzezinski called the Great Bear Trap, was to ensnare the Soviet Union and Afghanistan the way the United States had been brought down in Vietnam. And, of course, the process through which that was to be achieved was through fostering a huge terror apparatus to destabilize these countries. The Stalinist apparatus in the Soviet Union was ripe for this formulation because it was like a gangster-run trade union. The working class in the Soviet Union since the Bolshevik Revolution was dispossessed of political power. And the bureaucracy in the Soviet Union was constantly catering for sweetheart arrangements, sphere of influence deals to stabilize not just the Soviet bureaucracy but capitalism itself. That is what undermines the viability of a democratically controlled workers' production, the socialism that has been sullied by this detritus of the apparatus that brought down
Soviet
revolution.
At the time that the Soviet Union was ripe for a political revolution, that is when imperialism saw its opportunity to move and have the entire breakup.
But Maya, when we talk about imperialism, we're not dealing here with some kind of swear word or pejorative or polemic. It's a precise description of the realities of the structure of power. When we say that 1% of the population owns more than 95% of the rest of us combined, or that we have between 1 and 2% of the population that has control over 90% of the national wealth, bear in mind we have 5% of the world's population within our national frontiers. So let's call it 2%. It's really more like 1, but 2% of our population, yes, has control over 90% of the resources. But that only is for the benefit, nominally, of 5% of the population of the globe. Yet this tiny handful of people has control over 70% of the resources of the planet. By any standard, by any criterion, that's an empire. Now, Maya, let's listen to the voice of the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt's president of the National Industrial Conference Board, Virgil Jordan, on December 10th, 1940, right, by the way, after Pearl Harbor, an engineered event. But leaving aside the dynamics of Pearl Harbor, bear in mind that U.S. imperialism declared itself openly as the economy became completely dependent on military production. Here is what Virgil Jordan said at that time. Whatever the outcome of this war that we have undertaken, we have taken as well the road of imperialism on an economic plane as on all other planes of life. Yes, some fear this word imperialism, so well known and to some menacing. Most people prefer to mask this under the more vague expression, defense of the Western Hemisphere. But we are destined by our need, by our capacity, by the exigencies of our rule, to follow this road. We have no choice. We shall continue as we have during the past century, which we began with the seizure of the continent and proceeded to the annexation of Cuba and the Philippines. This empire sees its possibilities throughout this hemisphere and west of the Pacific. The scepter must fall in the hands of the United States. Now, that imperialism that is articulated as a defining policy for Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal for the government of the United States in 1940 is sustained by its imperialist reach through military means. And what we find with regard to the constant need to justify increased military expenditure, cannibalizing the infrastructure of our society, dispossessing the working class of the social gains for which they had fought over 100 years. That dynamic proceeds with the bugaboo of the specter of communism or subversion. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, brothers and sisters, what must they do? They no longer have a rationale. They're supposed to be a peace dividend. How do they warrant ever-increasing amounts of expenditure on arms? Let's just keep in mind that under the regime of Clinton, there was a greater increase in the expenditure for arms than there had been under the Reagan administration. And I mentioned that in particular because we're going to come forward in time to make clear that this is a crisis of capitalism as a system, that the two political parties are but one party, a facade of public relations types bought and paid for, a millionaire's club, that front for this very concentrated structure of power. And if we do not grasp this as a people, if we do not provide a strategy for struggle based upon this essential recognition of the nature of power in our society, we will but perpetuate its rule and prevent ourselves from reaching out to our own constituency, the mass of our own people. I think it's essential that we bear in mind that this movement today, the 9/11 movement, brought together today, in this past couple of days for a conference in New York in which Maya and I were the kickoff speakers, was organized around a call, Getting Ready for Mainstream. I suggest, brothers and sisters, that mainstream for us means Main Street, that our task is to get ready to reach out with a program for fundamental organization of political challenge to capitalism to the mass of our people.
Ralph, you mentioned the incredible reliance upon the military and the importance of creating a rationale. This rationale through the conferences of Benjamin Netanyahu and the institute that he and his father had set up in honor of his brother who died in one of the terror operations, the Israeli terror operations in Entebbe. And it is here during these incredible conferences that took place that Netanyahu stressed, and George Shultz was present, as many of the people of the ruling class were present and people from the press. And at that time, what they had said is that you have to understand that the ideological principle that will drive us from here on is that of terror. And we fast forward to 2001, and we have Air Force General Richard Myers, who was then the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, who was saying after the attacks on Afghanistan, quote, "It is very clear that Afghanistan is a small piece of the war. Afghanistan is only a small piece of the U.S. campaign that could last more than a lifetime." Now, this has been not just the rhetoric. This has been the day-after-day barrage upon the American people. And it is a barrage not just articulated by President Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, whoever is the chair of the Joint Chief of Staff, however they have their turnover. It is also the litany coming from the Democratic Party, particularly from Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. I think it's very important for us to discuss specifically when we talk about where do we go from here, the illusions that many people have today about Senator Barack Obama.
Well, Maya, I'm very eager to do that, but I would like to pick up on a point that you had just made, which I think is critical and needs a little further discussion. You mentioned about Netanyahu, who was, after all, a 27-year-old operative of the Central Intelligence Agency, proceeding under false names and false documentation. He had a Social Security card in the name of John L. Sullivan, John L. Sullivan Jr., Benjamin Netai, and Benjamin Netanyahu, and he organized conferences in Tel Aviv and in Washington with the likes of Bush Sr. and Shultz, George Shultz, and members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, around the category of terror and the necessity to launch a preemptive campaign globally against any opposition and resistance to U.S. policies, U.S. power, and of course the role of the Israeli state by designating it as terrorist. And that was reified and defined in the conference that subsequently took place in Washington. So with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the category of terror becomes the ideological rationale for maintaining not merely the imperial reach, but this gluttony of money given to the enforcement apparatus, the trillions upon trillions of dollars. And that's where 9/11 has to be understood, because in the late 70s, a seminal document, which was produced by Oded Yinon, we've documented it on Taking Aim, Brothers and sisters, if you go to our book, The Hidden History of Zionism, you'll find this document laid out in all its particularity. It calls for the dismantling of each Arab and Middle Eastern and Central Asian country ad seriatim in their turn. Iraq targeted, and Iran in particular, to be dismantled, its resources seen, these states to be decomposed. That is the policy of the Project for the New American Century. That is the defining policy of Brzezinski. That is whether their tactics are the same at a given moment in time, namely to use putches and coup d'etats and death squads, or to use direct all-out military assault and occupation. Those are tactical differences between sectors of the class. But that understanding is critical to being able to respond to imperialism and the capitalist structure, and to understand that they are whipsawing us between soft cops and hard cops who are all following the basic stratagems and structure of power controlling them as that always has. And we there, like hypnotized rats, are moving our eyes from right to nominal left and expected to choose between our oppressors and masters. Obama, Barack Obama, is that an alternative to Richard Cheney? I think not. I think it's important for us to understand that the two parties are financed by the same folks, peopled by the same apparatus. The presidential election 2004, the main fundraiser for Bush was the president of Citibank, and the main fundraiser for Kerry was the vice president of Citibank. Here is Barack Obama on September 4th, 2007. Hit Iran where it hurts. Democratic presidential hopeful has a get-tough stance against the tyrant of Tehran, by Barack Obama. Americans need to come together and confront the challenge posed by Iran. The decision to wage the war in Iraq has strengthened Iran, which poses for us the greatest strategic challenge in the Middle East in a generation. Iran supports violent groups and sectarians in Iraq. Iran fuels terror and extremism across the Middle East. Iran is making progress on a nuclear program in defiance of the international community. Iran calls for Israel to be wiped off the map. And Barack Obama follows up by calling for a preemptive military strike on Iran. He isn't satisfied with that. On August 3rd, 2007, Barack Obama calls for a United States attack on Pakistan. In warmongering address, writes the World Socialist website, speaking to the Woodrow Wilson School of International Center for Scholars, Obama called for more troops to be sent to Afghanistan and unilateral attacks against Iran and Pakistan and strengthening United States military and intelligence apparatus across the planet. This is a full program articulated by Barack Obama. There isn't a sliver of paper that can be slid in between the politics and the program and the articulation and the strategies of Barack Obama and the demonized Dick Cheney.
Ralph, you can understand this if you look and see who the mentor was and still is for U.S. Senator Barack Obama. The Boston Globe writing March 31st, 2006. U.S. Senator Barack Obama rallied Connecticut Democrats at their annual dinner Thursday night, throwing his support behind mentor and Senate colleague Joe Lieberman. This is an article that was published in the Boston Globe, written by Associated Press writer Stephanie Wrights. She continues, Obama, an Illinois Democrat who is considered a rising star in the Democratic Party, was the keynote speaker at the annual Jefferson Jackson Bailey dinner. Lieberman, Connecticut's junior senator, is under fire from some liberal Democrats for his support of the Iraq War. He was key in booking Obama, who routinely receives more than 200 speaking invitations each week. And what Wrights goes on to say is, Obama, quote, Obama wasted little time getting to the point, quote, I am absolutely certain Connecticut is going to have the good sense to send Joe Lieberman back to the U.S. Senate so he can continue to serve on our behalf. And writes notes, Lieberman became Obama's mentor when Obama was sworn into the Senate in 2005. They stayed close at Thursday night's event, entering the room together and working the crowd in tandem. Ralph?
Maya, Democratic keynote speaker Barack Obama calls for missile strikes on Iran. Want to know the date of that, brothers and sisters? October 1st, 2004. Chicago Tribune editorial board, Democratic Senate candidate Barack Obama called for missile strikes against Iran. The keynote speaker at the Democratic National Convention, being hailed as a rising star in the Democratic Party, when interviewed by the Chicago Tribune, stated explicitly that he is in favor of preemptive missile strikes against Tehran. Now, this was not a matter of Barack Obama striking a pose. This was in coordination with the Kerry campaign as well. The brother of John Kerry, Cameron Kerry, went to Tel Aviv and to Jerusalem, where he met with Ariel Sharon, where he attacked Bush from the right for not being sufficiently supportive of Sharon, and where he repeated the call for a missile strike against Iran. This call for a war against Iran with missiles, and by the way, tactical nuclear missiles are included in this demand. This entire scenario is not merely the neocon formula or the work of Dick Cheney. Cheney and his crew are linked at the hip to the Barack Obama wing of the ruling class, if you want to call it that, but I prefer to call it the apparatus of control of corporate capitalism. Because we have to grasp and understand, brothers and sisters, that this is a shell game. That this is designed to lure us into picking and choosing amongst those who have in mind the same old, continuous war and repression at home on a scale that we cannot begin to imagine.
And Ralph, this is a moment to pause for our station ID. This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, 6 years after 9/11. Where do we go from here, Ralph?
Well, Maya, I want to add one more point about this nature and character of the phenomenon of Barack Obama, who, you know, Barack Obama or Bomber or however you want to characterize Barack Obama is but a symptom. It's like, the boil that reveals the infection beneath the surface. He is an expression of a determination on the part of a crisis-ridden ruling class to make permanent war the formula for maintaining capitalism as a viable system. Of course, we'll deal with the economic calamity that the deficit financing that represents. But please keep in mind something, brothers and sisters. Before I address one more point about Barack Obama, let me remind you that Dwight David Eisenhower, when he was president of the United States in 1952 and 1953, gave a warning about what he called the military-industrial complex. It's often cited by liberals by way of showing that the military-industrial complex was called out by Dwight David Eisenhower, and I think we should look at that very carefully. Because what Eisenhower was saying on behalf of Eastern finance capital at the time was that the deficit financing of massive Pentagon operations was jeopardizing the stability of the dollar, and the deficit financing was undermining the ability of U.S. imperialism to challenge its junior partners, that the stability of the dollar as compared with the mark and the franc and the yen and the pound sterling was undermined by total dependence on military production. So what did Dwight David Eisenhower counterpose to massive military intervention with huge forces? What did he do in Iran, brothers and sisters, with John Foster Dulles as his Secretary of State? where they staged a terror operation and a putsch which removed the government of Mossadegh, elected in 1952, and which had nationalized the oil, and they imposed the Shah of Iran, and the Mossad and the CIA set up a terror apparatus in the form of a torture operation in which hundreds of thousands of people disappeared and were tortured to death and held incommunicado in prisons for decades. The same thing in Guatemala in 1954 under Dwight David Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles. They overthrew the Arbenz government in Guatemala with E. Howard Hunt carrying out this operation on behalf of U.S. imperialism. And by the way, you know where the headquarters of that operation were? 544 Camp Street in New Orleans, where E. Howard Hunt and the director of the FBI in Chicago carried out that operation against the Guatemala government. It would subsequently be the headquarters of the so-called Cuban Revolutionary Council, a dummy organization of the CIA, out of which the organizing of the assassination of Kennedy was prepared. It was the exact street address, as Jim Garrison established, as Joan Mellon has articulated in her book, A Farewell to Justice, as we in the Who Killed Kennedy Committee made clear in London in 1964. It's that address from which Lee Harvey Oswald's fake Fair Play for Cuba Committee, a one-person operation, was prepared as the patsy for the Kennedy execution. Oswald, the CIA op, was portrayed as a Fidel supporter. You begin to see the picture, brothers and sisters, how capitalism works, the schemes, the plots. It's not a question of the structure of power being managed by conspiracy, but it's rather, and conspiracy does not define history, but the ruling class has to operate in conspiratorial fashion. And so the Dwight David Eisenhower opposition to the military-industrial complex was conjoined to counter-revolution on the cheap. Terror squads and coup d'etats and assassinations and death squads and putches, the same formula that the Kennedy brothers used in Laos with the Phoenix Program and the Green Berets and the Rangers and the James Bond to which they were addicted. Counterposing that to massive military intervention with hundreds of thousands of troops, which a wing of Pentagon Capital favors, but which jeopardizes the stability of the dollar. And this debate within capitalism is about the means of survival by way of maintaining the imperium. Ain't nothing out there for us, brothers and sisters. There's nothing for us to choose between this collection of murderers and criminal oligarchs who want to preserve their imperium, their isolated rule, their ability to exploit, to pauperize, to dominate, to fragment, to send our people into a state of desperation with no health care, no social services, no secure work, no permanent jobs. The mad race to the sweatshop bottom is the counterpart to this. This is what's at stake, brothers and sisters, when we look at the captains of capital from Osama bin Laden to Dick Cheney. The same old, same old.
Ralph, you mentioned the splits within the ruling class. And this is most clearly elaborated with the master of the breakup of Soviet Union and the seizure, the control and seizure of Central Asia, Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, who was called to testify before Congress this past February. In front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And we've discussed this testimony by Zbigniew Brzezinski at length on Taking Aim in the past because of the clarity in which he spoke about creating another false flag operation, that is, another pretext for expanding war, particularly this time a nuclear strike against Iran. And in his testimony, he stated, quote, undertaken under false assumptions, he meant the war, and he's referring to the war, the assault, the attack on Iraq. It is undermining America's global legitimacy. Its collateral civilian casualties as well as some abuses are tarnishing America's moral credentials. Driven by Manichaean principles and imperial hubris, it is intensifying regional stability. End quote. Then he goes on to say, to argue that America is already at war in the region with a wider Islamic threat, of which Iran is the epicenter, is to promote a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now, what we have to understand is that Zbigniew Brzezinski is not a man opposed in his own context to false flag operations. He is not a man opposed to using counterinsurgency. He's not a man opposed to creating falsehoods for the American population as a rationale for invasion, military action. But here he is concerned. He was concerned at the time with the invasion of Iraq because he understood that militarily it was going to take at least 500,000 troops to stabilize, to control various areas of Iraq. He understood the costs. He understood that there would be an insurgent population in Iraq. So what we have here is the wing of capital that is concerned about the uprisings that will be engendered and particularly what it means here in the United States.
They want to buy time. They prefer, for example, what Clinton and Madeleine Halfbright did to Iraq with their blockade, which is now a blockade that Brzezinski is supporting for Iran as well, let me make clear. But that blockade cost, according to the United Nations, 1.6 million civilian lives and 750,000 children. And when Madeleine Albright was asked famously by a mainstream reporter, was it worth it? She said, absolutely correct. Gareth Porter in the Huffington Post, August 18, 2007, on an article, Cheney, Lieberman, and the Iran War Conspiracy, talks about the Cheney proposal for airstrikes against Iran, which is a purpose to provoke a retaliation that would make it possible for a full-fledged strategic air attack against Iran. But, of course, Lieberman and Osama bin Laden have been no less insistent and articulate. Osama Barack, please excuse me, brothers and sisters. I'm really losing it here because the associations are too clear in my mind, and that's a Freudian slip, which I think we can do without. But Barack Obama has been integral to the ruling class team and its designs. Look, you know, John Kerry, his key foreign policy advisors featured Rand Beer, so who took over FEMA from Oliver North under Ronald Reagan. Bear in mind that FEMA was originally called the Federal Emergency Military Administration, and under Rand Beers and Oliver North, it called for the incarceration of 21 million Negroes, according to the Miami Herald at the time. This is Rand Beers, who served on the National Security Council for George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. This is the Rand Beers who ran the color coding operation for determining what the level of terror was. Remember? Orange code, red code, yellow code, whatever code. That's Rand Beers, who then becomes the principal national security figure for who? For John Kerry. And I think we should look at one more thing about what Kerry stated at the time of the election. He said to the Wall Street Journal that this election in 2004 was, quote, about a change in CEO, unquote. He said, election day is nothing but a national shareholders meeting, unquote. His economic policymaker was Warren Buffett, the right-wing Republican billionaire who performed the same function for Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Gruppenführer. The economic team that Kerry brought was that of Lee Iacocca of the Chrysler bailout fame, David Bonderman of the Texas Pacific Group, who bankrupted Continental and American West Airlines and destroyed the unions, Bank of America Chairman Charles Gifford, August A. Bush IV, the President of Anheuser-Busch, and Peter Chairman, the Administrative Director of what? The Rupert Murdoch News Corporation, all of them registered Republicans and all key financiers of John Kerry's presidential opponent, George W. Bush. You got the picture, brothers and sisters? This is a shell game. This is a con game. This is the capitalist version of soft cop, hard cop. We can't buy into this, and that's why. Sorry, Mike, let me just make this particular point, and I'll finish on my what I want to say here. This call to impeach Cheney, which is frankly such a ludicrous notion. Who's going to do that impeaching, brothers and sisters? Barack Obama? The Democratic Party that says that, from Barbara Lee to John Conyers, that says the war in Iraq is the wrong war because it's preventing us from striking the terrorists in Afghanistan and beyond. Is that who's going to differentiate themselves from Cheney, let alone impeach him? They're on board. They're all on board, brothers and sisters. It's the same claque. It's a capitalist claque. It's an imperial claque. There ain't nothing there for us. To call for impeachment of Cheney is a liberal delusion because the forces that you would expect to be in a position to do that are on board for the same policies. That's the issue here. And I think it's essential to understand that when we're being whipsawed into hysterical calls that if we don't impeach Cheney, that they're going to declare martial law tomorrow. If we don't impeach Cheney,
Or impeach Bush.
36 hours from now, there will be nuclear strikes on Iran. They've been calling for that since 2004. They've been calling for that since 1977 with this document we cited about Oded Yinon, a strategy for the 1980s. Not to say the danger isn't imminent and real, but we cannot oppose it by delusional notions that impeaching Cheney is going to stop a damn thing. All it does is to channel our efforts away from mobilizing our own population.
And Ralph, I'd like to go to that because next weekend there is a large anti-war demonstration planned for Washington, D.C. And it is important that each and every one of us mobilize. And what we have seen time and again throughout my lifetime is that the anti-war mobilizations that arise, the unity is built, the mobilizations increase in size, but as the Democratic Party elections, as the presidential elections approach, and this is not only true of the anti-war movement, this came about during the pro-choice movement when the National Organization of Women was able to mobilize a million people in the streets of Washington, D.C., and then diverted that incredible energy towards electing Democratic Party candidates. And we have again and again seen with the anti-war movement where we build a tremendous momentum that can stop a war, and then the activity, the energy, the human resources and financial resources are then diverted for lesser evil. There is no lesser evil when you talk about U.S. presidential and congressional politics. The Democratic Party candidates of whatever stripe, however liberal they consider themselves to be on issues such as health care or pro-choice, still maintain the captains of capital.
Well, Maya, be very clear about this. Health care, the policies of these people is to enshrine the insurance companies. They have no capacity and no will to challenge corporate capital's relentless expenditure on arms. The Clinton administration was proceeding under the mantra of downsizing government and getting people off welfare. What they did was to completely destroy the public sector workers and their unionization. What they did with NAFTA was to destroy 500,000 manufacturing jobs in Mexico. They destroyed the ejidos, the main product of the Mexican Revolution, which was the collectivization through cooperatives of the land. They shut down the ejidos, and they drove those peasants, landless peasants, now into the cities as a reserve army of labor. That's the liberal design. Look, I want to mention a very particular thing. Lyndon LaRouche, is a fascist operation financed by the Defense Intelligence Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency. The LaRoucheites have been the excrement in the punch bowl that is supported by the intelligence apparatus of the U.S. now since the 1960s. They have huge amounts of money that are provided by the agency. They flood movements with their literature. And what they do is they, for example, right now, LaRouche lays out a basic political program. This literature is being handed out at the
outside
of the where did we meet? I'm suddenly blocking
Cooper
on.
Union.
At Cooper Union, excuse me. Here, LaRouche lays out a basic political program: get Cheney out. Get Cheney out. Impeach Cheney. That's the main operation that you have to do. You have to get Cheney out, and then, having got Cheney out, you have to bring back a New Deal formulated policy, says Lyndon LaRouche. Sounds good, huh? But Lyndon LaRouche is calling for what? He's calling for a corporatist structure. A corporatist structure, which is essentially that of Mussolini's fascism, in which the major elements of corporate power are intact, and indeed in which the patriotic military are the vehicle for the removal of Dick Cheney. But Dick Cheney is the scarecrow here, brothers and sisters. And what the LaRoucheites do is to contaminate anti-capitalist politics with a conjunction of this to the glorification of LaRouche as such, and for the calling for preservation of capitalism on a global scale, attributing so-called warmongering to the likes of Cheney alone, and also raising completely absurd notions such as that Putin in Russia is going to bombard the United States with nuclear weapons if the United States attacks Iran. What is this but disinformation designed to confound coherent description of the role of the Cheney faction, which is, as I say, not separable from the other elements of capital that are in favor of attacking Iran and maintaining imperial reach? We have to be clear that this is a disinformation operation. This is designed to make the ideas of the 9/11 movement stink in the nostrils of rational people. Let me give some citation of what this is conjoined with by the LaRoucheites. They say Bertrand Russell is the most evil man, more evil than Adolf Hitler. Every worst case of degeneracy in all British culture is summarized and compacted as an expression in the work of Bertrand Russell. Every degenerate, every worst case of degeneracy is summarized and compacted here, says Lyndon LaRouche of Bertrand Russell. Where does Bertrand Russell, with whom I worked, by the way, for 10 years, and who was a passionate opponent of imperialism, who launched the campaign for nuclear disarmament, who headed up the Tribunal on U.S. War Crimes in Indochina, why, of all people, would you want to demonize Bertrand Russell in conjunction with calls to impeach Cheney, brothers and sisters? Do you see what I'm trying to get at here? This is the disinformation campaign that associates calls that are attractive to people in the anti-war movement with a political strategy that is utterly lunatic.
Well, Ralph, in our remaining few minutes, let's address concretely again, where do we go from here, 6 years after 9/11? And first and most immediate is mobilize against the war and continue that mobilization. And Ralph, we have spoken time and again about the importance of a party independent of the parties of capital, the construction, as we moved often over the past years, for what we called a labor party that is based upon the working people of this country. But what would you put as your summary of the last few minutes of 6 years after 9/11? Where do we go from here?
Brothers and sisters, Maya was the communications director for the healthcare workers and for the workers, for professional technical engineers workers for many years, an organizer and advocate for the working class and the trade union movement. In 2004, I was the communications director for the Million Worker March movement, which was launched by ILWU Local 10, the longshore workers that had organized and shut down with a general strike on the West Coast, all of the ports around the case of Mumia, around the question of apartheid. We are rooted in struggles of the working class, I have to say to you, and I mention that for a particular reason. In the mission statement of the Million Worker March, and we mobilized at the Lincoln Memorial in 2004, where Martin Luther King had given his famous speech, I Had a Dream. And his son, Martin Luther King III, was with us on that day. In the mission statement of the Million Worker March, we declared, 36 years ago, Martin Luther King Jr. summoned working people across America to a poor people's march on Washington to inaugurate a war on poverty at home. The United States government, he proclaimed, is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. America is at a crossroads in history. It is critically important for us as a nation and as a society to choose a new path and move on it with resolution and courage. And in that mission statement, we said, the crisis facing working people today is ever more acute. Under the cover of systematic lies and deceptions, wars of devastation have been launched at the expense of working people everywhere. In our name, a handful of the rich and powerful corporations have usurped our government. A corporate and banking oligarchy changes hats and occupies public office to wage class war on working people. They have captured the state in their own interests. The vast majority of working Americans are under siege. Social services and essential funding for schools and libraries and affordable housing and health care are slashed and eliminated. And we said, the time has come to mobilize working people for our own agenda. Let us end subservience to the power of the privileged few and their monopoly of the political process. Come together, brothers and sisters. Join a Million Worker March on Washington as we launch a great movement for social change. Forge together a social, economic, and political movement for working people. We are the many, the secretive and corrupt who control our lives are the rapacious few. What is that a summons for? Political organization, a political party based on working people, a political party based upon the oppressed black sector of our working class, subject to rapine and constant brutal counterinsurgency attack. This is our constituency, brothers and sisters. This is the movement we have to build. This is what it means not to go mainstream but to main street. We need a political response. We need an organized response. We need a challenge to capitalist power. We have to seize power from these people. We have to save ourselves, our society. We have to speak to our constituents and build a struggle for nothing less than what Thomas Jefferson called for when he said, God forbid we should ever be 20 years without a revolution. The blood of tyrants is democracy's natural manure. Forward the struggle, brothers and sisters. Organized political response to the capitalist domination of our lives that threatens permanent war.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, 6 years after 9/11, Where Do We Go From Here, was recorded September 10th, 2007. We will be with you next week, but in the meantime, listen to our program again on the WBAI archive, www.wbai.org, or on our website, www.takingaimradio.com.